We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Brooks Jensen, Anacortes, Washington. Master and Man by Leo Tolstoy. Section 6. Vasily was warm enough in his two heavy coats, especially after his exertions in the snowdrift. Yet, for all that, the frost seemed to breathe down his back when he understood that they had to spend the night there. To calm his apprehensions, he sat down in the sledge and pulled out his matches and cigarettes. Meanwhile, Nikita unharnessed the cob. He undid the belly band and saddle piece, ran the reins out, unfastened the traces, and took off the duga, talking cheerily to the animal the while. "Out you come, out you come," he said as he led it out of the shafts. "Let me take off your bit and tie you up here, and then you shall have some straw." He suited the action to the word. "Eat away, and you will feel all the better for it." Nevertheless, Brownie did not seem to grow easier under Nikita's touch, but kept fidgeting about as he stood tail onwards to the wind. Every moment he would shift his legs, press up to the sledge, and rub his head against Nikita's sleeve. However, as if unwilling to seem churlish about the meal of the straw which Nikita had strewn before his nose, he took an occasional straw from the sledge, but appeared at once to come to the conclusion that straw did not meet the case and threw it down again, whereupon the wind caught it in a twinkling, whirled it away, and buried it in the snow. "Suppose we make a signal of distress," said Nikita presently. He turned the sledge a little towards the wind, tied the shafts together with the belly band, turned them up, and rested them against the splashboard. "Now, if anyone passes this way, they will be able to see us by the shafts and come and dig us out. I learnt this trick from the old people," and he clapped his mittens together and put them on. Meanwhile, Vasily had unhooked his fur coat and made a shelter of its skirts. Then he struck match after match against the steel matchbox, but his hands were shaking so violently with the cold that each successive match either failed to light at all or was blown out by the wind as he was in the act of lifting it to his cigarette. At length a match did flare up properly, illuminating for a brief second the pelt of his fur coat, his hand with his gold ring on its curved index finger, and the snow-covered straw which projected from under the sacking. The cigarette lighted, he drew a couple of greedy whiffs, swallowed the smoke, and puffed it out again through his mustache. Then he was about to take a third whiff when the wind caught the lighted end of the cigarette and carried it away to join the wisps of straw. Nevertheless, even these meager mouthfuls of smoke had exercised a cheering effect upon him. "If we must spend the night here, well, we must, that's all," he said undauntedly. "Wait a minute, and I will rig up a flag." Picking up the handkerchief which he had unwound from his neck and thrown down upon the floor of the sledge, he took off his mittens, climbed onto the splashboard, stretched himself up on tiptoe to reach the belly band, and tied the handkerchief round one end of it and of the shaft in a stout knot. The handkerchief at once began to wave wildly, now clinging to the shaft, now suddenly filling out again and straining at the knot as its folds cracked in the wind. "Is that not clever of me?" said Vasily as he stepped down again, much pleased with his handiwork. "Now, if we could lie together, that would be the warmest way, but I'm afraid there isn't room for both of us." "Never mind. I will find a place for myself," answered Nikita. "Only I must cover the cob over first, for he has been sweating a lot and is tired out. Wait a minute," and diving into the sledge, he dragged the sacking from under Vasily. Possessed of this, he folded it double and, removing the saddle piece and crupper from Brownie's back, covered him over. "You will be warmer like this, little fool," he said, as he replaced the saddle piece and crupper. "And now," he said to Vasily, "I will take the apron if you don't want it tonight. Give me some straw, too." And thus taking one thing and another from beneath Vasily, he went to the back of the sledge, dug a hole in the snow there, and lined it with the straw. Then he pulled his cap over his eyes, wrapped his halat about him, with the apron over all, and squatted down upon the straw with his back resting against the bark tailboard of the sledge, that it might protect him from the wind and snow. Vasily shook his head in disapproval of Nikita's proceedings. It was contrary to his habit to encourage the peasantry in their rude, uncouth ways, and then set about making his own preparations for the night. First of all, he smoothed out what straw was left in the sledge, padding it a little thicker where his thigh-bone was to rest. Then he pulled on his mittens and lay down with his head in one of the corners near the splashboard, that the latter might protect him from the wind. Somehow he did not feel sleepy, but lay thinking. He thought chiefly of the one thing which constituted his whole pride, ideal, aim, and joy in life, namely, the making of money, and yet more money. He thought of the means by which certain acquaintances of his had made their money, how they were using it, and the means by which he, like they, might make a great deal more than he already possessed. The purchase of the Goviatchkinsky forest seemed to him a matter of vast importance, since out of this forest he hoped to make, at one stroke, a sum, possibly, of 10,000 rubles. He mentally reckoned up the value of the timber which he had viewed in the autumn, and on the basis of the two dacoitins he had then inspected, went on to calculate the whole. Here the translator inserts a footnote that a dacoitin is 2 4/5 acres. "The oak wood will do for sledge runners if cut up, and for beams as they stand," he said to himself. "And after they are felled, there should be left about 30 sajens of firewood to the dacoitin." Here the translator inserts another footnote that a sajen is about 7 English feet. Thus calculating, he could see that the total value of the forest worked out to about 12,000 rubles, but could not reckon to an exact figure in the absence of tables. "All the same," he went on, "I am not going to give even so much as 10,000 for it, only 8,000, and that subject to deductions for open spaces. I will grease the surveyor's palm with 100 rubles, or perhaps 150, and he will measure me off the clearings at least 5 dacoitins. Yes, the owner will be glad to let the forest go at 8,000 rubles. I have 3,000 ready for him here," thought Vasily as he felt for his pocketbook with the inside of his forearm, "and that should melt him. How on earth we came to miss that turning, God only knows. There must be a forest and a forest keeper somewhere about there. His dog ought to have heard us. The cursed brutes never bark when they're wanted to." He turned back his coat collar from his ear and listened. Nothing was to be heard but the whistling of the wind, the rustling and cracking of the handkerchief on the shafts, and the swish of the snow as it lashed the bark sides of the sledge. He covered his ear over again. "If only I had known that we should have to spend the night here," he thought. "Well, we shall get there tomorrow, all the same. It will only mean one day lost. Besides, those other fellows wouldn't come either, not in such weather." Suddenly he remembered that on the 9th of the month he was to be paid some money for wethers by the butcher. I ought to be back by then to receive it. He couldn't take me in over the price, whereas my wife doesn't in the least know how to bargain. In fact, she doesn't understand how to talk to anyone, he went on, as he remembered her failure to make conversation to the Stanovoy, who had been one of their guests of yesterday for the festival. Here the translator inserts a footnote that a Stanovoy is the local magistrate. She is a woman. That is the long and the short of it. Moreover, what had she ever seen before I married her? Her father was only a well-to-do mujik, a shabby little farm. That was all his property. But what have I not acquired in 15 years? A store, 2 taverns, a mill, a granary, 2 rented holdings, and an iron-roofed villa and warehouse combined. He swelled with pride. Rather different to her father, I think. In fact, who is the chief man of the district today? Why, Vasily Brukhanov, of course. And why so? He continued presently. Because I devote my whole attention to business and work hard, not like some people who lie abed and play the fool. I don't sleep whole nights away. No. Blizzard or no blizzard. Out I go, if necessary, and my business gets done. They think me a fool, and laugh at my money-making. But never mind, Vasily, go on working hard, even if it makes your head ache. If necessary, spend a night in the open like this, rather than lose time. Never mind if you cannot sleep, either. To be able to think such thoughts is a pillow in itself, he concluded proudly. Some people seem to think that riches come to one by chance. Pooh, there is only one Mironov in a million. No, work hard, and God will give you the rest. If only He give you health and strength, that alone should be sufficient. And the mere thought that he might one day become such a millionaire as Mironov, who had risen from nothing, so fired Vasily with ecstasy that he yearned to have someone to speak to. Yet there was no one. Ah, but once he could win to Goviatchkina, he would have a landowner to speak to, and to bamboozle as well. Good heavens, how it blows, he continued, as he listened to a squall of wind which was beating against the splashboard and bending it inwards as it lashed the bark planking with snow. It is drifting the snow so much that perhaps we shall never get out in the morning. Nothing could be seen in the white swirl of obscurity but Brownie's dark head and tail and the sack covering his back. At intervals, the wind would toss the corners of the sack aloft, while in front and behind and on the other side of the sledge whirled the same uniform mass of whiteness, now lightening a little, now suddenly becoming denser. I was a fool to have ever listened to Nikita, he thought. We ought to have gone on again, and we should have landed somewhere. We might have reached Grishkino again and been able to put up at Tarasa's place after all. Yet here we have to stick all night. What is the good of that? God gives to those who help themselves, but not to loafers, sluggards, and fools. I must try smoking again. He sat up, got out a cigarette, and then rolled over on his stomach to shield the flame of the match from the wind with the flap of his coat. Yet the wind found an entry somehow and blew out the matches, one by one. At length he contrived to keep one alight and started smoking. He felt greatly pleased with his success, and although the wind got more of the smoke than he did, he managed to draw 3 whiffs and was much cheered by them. He rolled himself back into a sitting posture, wrapped himself up again, and started once more to think over and consider matters, until suddenly, and without warning, he lost consciousness and went off into a doze. All at once, something seemed to jostle him, and he awoke. It might have been Brownie pulling away straw from beneath him, or it might have been the result of some internal disturbance, but at all events he awoke, and with his heart beating so fast and so furiously that the very sledge seemed to be shaking under him. He opened his eyes. The scene around him appeared exactly the same, except that it seemed lighter. It must be dawn, he thought to himself. It will soon be morning now. Then all at once he remembered that the fact of its getting lighter could only mean that the moon was rising. He raised himself again and looked at the cob. Brownie was standing with his hindquarters to the wind and shaking all over. The snow-heaped sacking was turned up over his back on the windward side, and the crupper was slipping down over his flank, while his snow-powdered head and wind-tossed mane and forehead tuft were more clearly visible than before. As for Nikita, he was still squatting in the same position as when he had first sat down, with his feet and the apron with which he had covered his head all piled with snow. "A mujik never freezes," thought Vasily as he bent over the back of the sledge and looked at him. "No, not for all his poor clothes. He can be trusted for that. Yet the mujiks are a stupid lot, a mere welter of ignorance." For a moment he thought of taking the sacking off the cob's back and covering Nikita over with it, but it was too cold to get up and make the effort. Moreover, he was afraid of the cob starving if he did. "What on earth did I take Nikita for?" he reflected. "I have her stupidity to thank for it all," he was thinking of his wife. Then he rolled back into his former position by the splashboard. "My uncle spent a night in the snow like this," he went on, "yet he took no harm. Sebastian, too, once had to be dug out," he continued as another instance occurred to him. "Sebastian died, though, for he was frozen stiff as a carcass. If only we had stayed at Grishkino." Wrapping his coat more carefully about him, so that the protection of the fur should not be wasted at any point, but keep him warm from head to heels, he closed his eyes and tried to sleep again. Yet for all his efforts, he could not succeed, but on the contrary, continued absolutely alert and wakeful. Once more he began to make business calculations and to run over his outstanding debts. Once more, too, he began to appraise himself and to congratulate himself on his position in the world. Nonetheless, his every thought seemed to be broken in upon by a sort of haunting fear, as well as by a feeling of vexation, that they had not stayed at Grishkino. "To think of it," he murmured, "why, at this moment I might have been lying in a warm bed." More than once he turned himself over and resettled himself in a vain endeavor to find an easier position and one more protected from the wind, but each new posture proved more uncomfortable than the last. At length he raised himself again, changed his position altogether, wrapped his legs up carefully, closed his eyes, and tried to lie perfectly still. Yet either his feet, squeezed into their stiff top boots, had begun to ache, or the wind was catching him somewhere, but at all events he had not been lying long in this position before he found himself angrily remembering that at this very moment he might have been lying in a warm hut at Grishkino. Again he raised himself, again he wrapped his coat about him and resettled himself. Once he thought he heard the far-off sound of cocks crowing, whereupon he turned down the collar of his coat in a tremor of joy and listened attentively. Yet for all his straining of his ears, he could hear nothing but the whistling of the wind through the shafts, the flapping of the handkerchief, and the lashing of the snow against the bark sides of the sledge. As for Nikita, he remained squatting as he had done since the previous evening. Never once had he stirred, nor returned any answer to Vasily's shouts, although the latter had called him more than once. "He seems to have no difficulty in sleeping," thought Vasily with irritation, as he leant over the back of the sledge and looked at the snow-covered Nikita. In all, Vasily must have got up and lain down again at least 20 times. It seemed to him as if the night would never end. "Surely it must be morning now," he thought once as he raised himself and glanced about him. "How would it be to look at my watch? But no, I might get frozen if I unhooked my coat. Yet once I knew that it was drawing towards morning, things would seem better, and we would set about harnessing the cob." In the depths of his soul, however, Vasily knew quite well that it could not be near morning yet. The truth was that his nervous panic was increasing to such an extent that he wished both to verify his supposition and to deceive himself. In the end, he finished by carefully unhooking his fur coat, thrusting his hand in, and groping about till he dug down to his waistcoat. A further series of efforts enabled him to draw out his silver watch with its enameled chasing of flowers. Then he tried to look at it, but nothing could be seen without a light. Once more he lay down upon his elbows and stomach, as he had done when getting ready to smoke, pulled out his matches, and set about striking one. By this time he had grown more expert at the business, and, feeling for the match with the largest head of sulphur, he contrived to light it at the first attempt. Then, thrusting the dial of the watch under the light, he looked at it and could hardly believe his eyes. It was only 10 minutes past one. The whole night lay before him. "Oh, the long, long night," he groaned, feeling as though the frost were striking down his back already. Then, hooking up his coat again and wrapping it about him, he sat back in the corner of the sledge and prepared to wait with what patience he might. Suddenly, above the monotonous wail of the wind, he heard a new sound, a sound made by some living creature. It grew steadily louder, attained its maximum, and began to steadily die away again. There could be no doubt what it was. It was a wolf. Nor was the beast so far off that the wind could drown the gradations of tone in its howl as it moved its jaws from side to side. Vasily put back his coat collar from his ear and listened strainedly. Brownie was doing the same, his ears sharply pricked, and when the howl ceased, he changed his legs and snorted uneasily. After this, Vasily found it more than ever impossible to sleep, found it impossible to steady his nerves for a moment. The more he tried to think of his business affairs and accounts, his reputation, dignity, and wealth, the more did terror begin to master him. While above all other thoughts, and yet mixed up with them, floated the persistent question, "Why did we not stop the night at Grishkino?" "God be with that landowner and his forest," he thought to himself. "Yet I wish I had never come across either of them. To have to spend the night here. They say that men who have been drinking always freeze readily, and I have been drinking tonight." Listening thus to his own suggestions, he could feel himself beginning to tremble, though he hardly knew why, whether from cold, that is to say, or from fear. He tried to cover himself up and lie down as before, but found this impossible. He could not remain still even for a second, but felt as if he must be up and doing something to stifle the terror which was rising in him and against which he felt himself powerless. He got out his matches and cigarettes once more, but of the former there remained but three, and they were of the sorriest kind. Indeed, all of them fizzled out, without lighting when struck. "The devil take you, you cursed bit of rubbish! Go and be hanged to you!" he burst out, though he hardly knew what he was swearing at, as he hurled the battered cigarette away. The matchbox was about to follow when he stayed his hand and thrust the box into his pocket. Such a fit of restlessness now seized upon him that he could stay no longer where he was. Leaping from the sledge, and standing with his back to the wind, he began lowering and tightening up his belt again. "Why should we lie here, waiting for death to come?" he exclaimed as a new idea suddenly struck him. "Why not mount the cob and ride away? With only a man on his back, he would never stick fast." Then he thought of Nikita. "Oh, but it would be nothing to him to die," he went on. "What can life matter to him? He has nothing much to lose with it, whereas I have much to gain with mine." So he untied the cob, threw the halter over its neck, and tried to mount. But his fur coat and boots weighed him down, and he slipped back every time. Then he climbed onto the sledge and tried to mount from there, but the sledge kept rocking under his weight, and he failed again. At length, and for the third time, he drew the cob close to the sledge, balanced himself cautiously on the rim, and succeeded so far as to find himself stretched face down athwart the animal's back. Lying thus, he wriggled himself forward once or twice until he had got his leg over and seated himself, his toes resting in the trace loops of the saddle piece. But the jolting of the sledge as it shook under Vasily's weight had awakened Nikita, who now raised himself and seemed to Vasily to be saying something. "Look here, you fool," shouted Vasily. "It's all through you that we have got into this plight, got into it for nothing, too." And tucking the flapping skirts of his greatcoat beneath his knees, he turned the cob round and rode away from the sledge in the direction where he thought the forest and the forest keeper's lodge must be. This ends section 6. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Brooks Jensen, Anacortes, Washington. Master and Man by Leo Tolstoy. Section 7. Up to this moment, Nikita had never once stirred since he first squatted down behind the sledge and covered himself over with the apron. Like all people who live in close contact with nature and are familiar with hardship, he was patient and could sit waiting for hours, or even for days, without growing restless or losing his temper. He had heard his master call out to him twice, yet he had returned no answer, for the sole reason that he did not feel inclined to stir or go to the trouble of raising his voice. Although he was warm enough at the time he had sat down, both with the tea which he had drunk and with the exertion of plunging through snowdrifts, he knew that that would not last long, and he would be powerless to restore the warmth by exercising himself, since he felt as utterly worn out as a horse feels when he stops and can go no further, despite the severest whipping, and his master sees that no further work can be got out of him until he has been rested and fed. Moreover, one of his feet had got frostbitten through its ragged boot, so that the big toe had lost all sensation, and his whole body was becoming steadily colder and colder. Consequently, in time, the thought began to enter his head that he might have to die that night. Yet the thought was neither particularly unwelcome nor particularly awe-inspiring. It was not particularly unwelcome for the reason that his life had not been exactly an uninterrupted holiday, but, on the contrary, a life of ceaseless servitude, of which he was beginning to grow weary. Nor did the thought seem to him particularly awe-inspiring, for the reason that, over and above the masters whom he had served on earth, masters such as Vasily Andreyitch, he had always felt himself dependent upon the great master who had sent him into this life, and knew that, in dying, he would still remain that master's servant, and that that master would be good to him. "Should I be sorry to leave the life in which I am settled and which I am accustomed to?" he thought. "Well, even if I have to go, I cannot help myself, and it were best to prepare for the new one. My sins," he went on presently as he remembered his drunken orgies, the money squandered on drink, his insults to his wife, his frequent oaths, his neglect of church-going, his non-observance of fast days, and all the many things for which the priest had reproved him at confession time. "Well, of course they were sins. I have never denied that. But it was God who made me what I am. Yet what terrible sins they have been! What will become of me for such sins?" Then, from thinking of what might be in store for him the night he passed, without recurring to that thought, to memories which came into his head at random. He thought of Martha's arrival, of the workmen's carouse, of his refusal to share their liquor of the present expedition, of Tarasa's hut, of the talk about family separations, of his little lad, of Brownie, now doubtless growing warm under his sacking, and of the master who was making the sledge creak above him as he tossed and turned. Well, I had plenty of tea to drink there, and was tired, he thought. I had no wish to start out again. I had no wish to leave such good living to come and die in this hole. Yet he wished otherwise. Then all these memories swam together and jumbled themselves up in his head, and he went off into a doze. From this doze, he was awakened by Vasily shaking the sledge as he mounted the cob, shaking it so violently that it slewed right around and struck Nikita in the back with one of its runners, forcing him, willy-nilly, to shift his position. Stretching out his legs with some difficulty and sweeping the snow off them, he raised himself a little and at once felt a pang shoot through his body. Understanding at the first glance what Vasily intended to do, he begged him to leave the sacking behind, since the cob no longer needed it, and it would make an additional covering for himself. He shouted to Vasily to that effect, but the latter disappeared in the snow dust without heeding him. Left alone, Nikita considered what he had better do. He felt that he had not sufficient strength also to go off in search of a human habitation, while it was impossible for him to resume his old seat, since the snow had filled up the hole already. Even if he got into the sledge, things would not mend, for he had no extra covering, and his halat and fur jacket no longer kept him warm. He could not have felt colder if he had been clad only in a shirt. The situation was becoming one of positive agony. "Little Father, our little Father in heaven," he cried aloud, and the knowledge that he was not alone, but that there was one who could hear him and would never abandon him, brought him comfort. He drew a deep sigh, and with the apron still covering his head, crept into the sledge and lay down where his master had been. Even there, however, he could not grow warm. At first he kept shivering all over. Then the shivering fit passed away, and he began to lose consciousness. He might have been dead or asleep, for all he could tell, yet felt prepared for either eventuality. This ends Section 7. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Brooks Jensen, Anacortes, Washington. Master and Man by Leo Tolstoy. Section 8. Meanwhile, Vasily was using his heels and the spare end of the halter to urge the cob in the direction where, for some reason or another, he supposed the forest and the forest-keeper to be. The snow blinded his eyes, and the wind seemed as if it were struggling to stop him, but, bending forward at times to double the skirts of his coat and tuck them between his knees and the icy saddle-piece, which made his seat such an uncomfortable one, he pressed the cob onwards, unceasingly. The animal moved with difficulty, yet proceeded whither it was directed, in its usual docile manner. For what seemed to him some 5 minutes, Vasily rode straight ahead, seeing nothing in front of him but the cob's head and ears and a sea of whiteness, and hearing nothing but the whistling of the wind over the cob's ears and round the collar of his fur coat. Suddenly, however, something black showed up before him. His heart began to beat hopefully, and he rode towards the object, imagining that he already discerned in its outlines the walls of the houses forming a village. The object did not keep still, however, but was forever waving from side to side. In fact, it turned out to be not a village, but a tall piece of wormwood, which, growing out of the boundary ridge and projecting above the snow, bent violently over to one side each time the wind struck it and went whistling through its stems. Somehow, the sight of this wormwood thus tortured by the cruel wind caused Vasily to shudder, and he restarted the cob in haste, without noticing that, in turning aside to the wormwood, he had deviated from his former direction and was now riding at a tangent to it. Nonetheless, He imagined himself still to be bearing in the fancied direction of the forest keeper's hut, and although the cob kept trying to swerve to the right, he as often straightened it again to the left. For the second time, a dark object loomed up before him, filling his heart with joy, since he felt certain that this time here was a village at last. Yet it proved to be only another boundary ridge topped with wormwood. As in the case of the first one, the sound of the wind wailing through the dried stems seemed to fill Vasily with fear. This piece of wormwood was exactly similar to the other piece in all respects save one, namely that beside this second piece ran the track of a horse's hooves, slightly powdered over with snow. Vasily pulled up, leaned forward, and looked at the track carefully. It was the track of a small-sized hoof, and the covering of snow upon it was, as yet, a mere sprinkling. In short, it was the track of his own cob. He had described a complete circle, and that not a large one. "So this is how I am to perish," he thought. Then, lest he should yield to his terror, he started forward again and urged the cob even more strenuously than before. At every moment, as he strained his eyes into the swirl of whiteness before him, he seemed to see dark points stand out for a second and then vanish as soon as he looked at them. Once he thought he heard what might have been either the barking of a dog or the howl of a wolf, but the sound was so faint and uncertain that he could not be sure whether he had really heard anything or whether it had only been his fancy. He stopped and listened attentively. Suddenly, a weird, startling cry sounded in his very ears, and everything beneath him seemed to heave and tremble. He clutched the cob's mane, yet found that it too was quivering, while the cry grew ever more and more piercing. For some seconds, Vasily could not frame a thought or understand in the least what was happening. Yet all that had happened was that the cob had been seized with the idea either of inspiriting himself or calling for help, and had neighed loudly in his raucous, guttural tones. "How the beast frightened me! Be hanged to it!" gasped Vasily to himself. Yet although he understood now the cause of his terror, he could not shake himself free from it. "I must consider things a moment and steady myself," he thought. It was all to no purpose, for he could not master himself, could not keep from urging the cob on, taking no heed the while that he was now riding before the wind instead of against it. His body was chilled and aching all over, but especially in the lower part next to the saddle piece, where his coat was unhooked, whilst his hands and feet were shaking violently, and his breath came in gasps. He felt sure now that he was to perish in the midst of this fearful waste of snow, and that nothing could save him. Suddenly the cob gave a groan as it stuck fast in a snowdrift, and, struggling violently, began to sink sideways onto its flank. Vasily leapt off, displacing as he did so the trace loops in which his feet had been resting, and so also the saddle piece on which he had been seated. Yet he had no sooner dismounted than the cob righted himself, lurched forward, took a couple of plunges, and disappeared with a loud neigh, trailing behind him the sacking and the harness, and leaving Vasily stranded in the snowdrift. Vasily made a rush to catch him, but the snow was so deep and his fur coat so heavy that he sank knee-deep at every step, and had taken no more than 20 strides when his breath failed him and he had to stop. The timber, the weathers for the butcher, the rentold land, the store, the taverns, the iron-roofed villa and warehouse, my little heir, am I to leave them all, he thought? Is it to end like this? No, no, it cannot be. For some reason or another, there came into his mind at that moment a picture of the wormwood waving in the wind, and of himself twice riding up to it. Such terror seized upon him that he could hardly believe in the reality of what was happening. "I must be dreaming it all," he thought, and tried, as it were, to awake from his dream. Yet there was no awakening for him. It was a real snow that was lashing his face, heaping his form over, and chilling his right hand which had lost its mitten. It was a real desert, too, in which he was now left lonely as the wormwood, and in which he must await an imminent, a swift, and an unthinkable death. O Queen of Heaven, O Holy Father St. Nicholas, who teaches us abstinence, he began, with a dim recollection of the Thanksgiving service of yesterday and the icon with its blackened face and gold vestment and the candles for that icon which he had sold and which returned to him straightway he had replaced in his locker after lighting them for a brief moment. Again and again he besought the wonder-working St. Nicholas to save him from his fate, promising in return a thanksgiving and many candles. Yet all the time he knew beyond the possibility of doubt that, although that blackened face and golden vestment, as well as the candles, the priest, and the thanksgivings, were all of them very important and necessary there in the church, they could do nothing for him here, and that between those candles and thanksgivings on one hand, and his present forlorn plight on the other, there could be no real connection whatever. "Still, I must not despair," he thought. "I have only to follow the cob's track before it gets snowed over, and it will bring me out somewhere. Only I must not hurry too much, or I might plunge into another snowdrift and be worse off than ever." Nevertheless, for all his determination to go quietly, he could not help quickening his pace, breaking into a run, tumbling down continually, picking himself up again, and once more falling. Moreover, the cob's track was almost invisible where the snow was not deep. "I am done for," he said at last. "I am not following the cob's track at all, but only losing myself." Just as he said this, however, he happened to glance ahead and caught sight of something dark there. It was Brownie, and not Brownie alone, but also the shafts and the handkerchief. The cob was standing beside the sledge, with the harness and sacking still dangling down his flank, but standing in a different position to before, since he was just under the shafts and had his head, which he kept shaking at intervals, drawn close to the ground by the halter which had caught round his pastern. It seemed that Vasily had stuck fast in the same ravine as that into which Nikita and he had previously blundered, that, as a matter of fact, the cob had been carrying him straight back to the sledge, and that at the moment when he jumped off, he had been only 50 paces from it. This ends Section 8. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Brooks Jensen, Anacortes, Washington. Master and Man by Leo Tolstoy. Section 9. Staggering up to the sledge, Vasily grasped hold of it and stood for a long time, without moving, as he endeavored to steady himself and regain his breath. There was nothing to be seen of Nikita in his old position, but in the sledge there lay something heaped with snow, which Vasily guessed to be his servant. Vasily's terrors had now vanished, or, if any were left, it was merely lest he should have a return of the horrible panic which he had experienced on the cob's back, and, still more, when he found himself left in the snowdrift. At all costs, he must not give way to that panic again. And if he would avoid that, he must be up and doing something, must be occupying his thoughts with something. First of all, he planted himself with his back to the wind and unfastened his fur coat to cool himself. Then, when he had regained his breath a little, he shook the snow off his boots and left-hand mitten. The other one was hopelessly lost and probably lying somewhere a couple of inches below the snow, and refastened his belt tightly, much as he was accustomed to do when he was about to step out of his store to buy cartloads of grain which the mujiks had brought. This done, he set about exerting himself. The first thing which it occurred to him to do was to disentangle the cob's leg, and, the halter thus freed, he tied Brownie up to the rim of the splashboard where he had been tied before. Next, he had just gone behind the cob to straighten the crupper, sacking, and saddle-piece on his back, when he saw something stir in the sledge, and then the head of Nikita emerged from beneath the snow which covered it. The frozen man raised himself a little, though evidently with a great effort, and made a strange gesture with his hand in front of his face, as though he were brushing away a fly. As he did this, he seemed to Vasily to be saying something, probably Vasily's name. So the latter left the sacking unstraightened and stepped up to the sledge. "How is it with you now?" he asked. "And what are you trying to say?" "Only that I am dying," answered Nikita, with difficulty and in gasps. "Give my wages to the little lad or to the wife. It does not matter which." "Are you frozen, then?" said Vasily. "Yes, and dying. I know it quite well," replied Nikita in a choking voice, and still fluttering his hand before his face as though to brush away a fly. "Pardon me for Christ's sake." For about half a minute Vasily stood without moving and in silence, and then all at once, and with the same air of decision as marked him when he had struck hands over a good bargain, he took a step backwards, tucked up the sleeves of his coat, and began with both hands to rake the snow off Nikita and out of the sledge. This done, he unhooked his belt, opened his fur coat, pushed Nikita hastily into a straight posture, and lay down upon him in such a way that the latter should be covered not only with the coat, but with Vasily's own warm, overheated body. With one skirt of the coat tucked between Nikita's form and the side of the sledge, and the tail of it grasped between his ankles, Vasily remained lying prone, with his head resting upon the splashboard and his ears deaf either to the movements of the cob or to the howling of the wind, but intent only on listening to Nikita's breathing. For a long time Nikita lay without moving. Then he gave a deep sigh and stirred faintly. "There you are, you see, and yet you talk of dying," began Vasily. "Just you lie still and grow warm, and we—" To his great surprise, Vasily found that he could say no more, for tears were welling from his eyes, and his lower jaw was working. He broke off short and swallowed a lump in his throat. "How absurdly weak and nervous I have made myself," he thought. Yet not only did he find this weakness far from unpleasant, but it actually gave him a sensation of joy as he had never yet experienced. "Yes, we shall manage it all right like this," he said to himself, conscious of a rapturous feeling of emotion. After this, he lay for a long time in silence, merely wiping his eyes against the fur of the coat and tucking back its right-hand skirt as the wind blew it up at intervals. But at length he felt as though he must communicate his joy to a fellow creature. "Nikita," he said. "That is better. I am getting warm now," came from underneath him. "Nikita, my old friend, I thought we were done for. You would have been frozen, and I—" Once more Vasily's cheeks started quivering and his eyes filled with tears, so that he could say no more. "No, it is no good," he said to himself. "Yet I know what I know," and he remained silent. Still he lay there. Warmth seemed to be passing into his body from Nikita below and from the fur coat above. Only the hands with which he held the skirts of the coat against Nikita's sides, and his feet, from between which the wind kept blowing the skirts away, were beginning to feel frozen. His mittenless right hand, in particular, felt numbed. Yet he never thought of his hands or feet, only how he could best warm the peasant who was lying beneath him. More than once he glanced at the cob and saw that its back was uncovered, since the sacking had now slipped off altogether and was lying in the snow. He felt as if he ought to go and cover the animal over again, yet could not make up his mind to leave Nikita, even for a moment, and thus break the spell of that rapturous joy which now possessed him. As for his terrors, they had long since fled away. "By heavens, I am not going to be beaten," he said to himself with reference to his efforts to warm Nikita, speaking indeed in just the same boastful tone in which he had been accustomed to speak of his sales or purchases. He lay for an hour, for two, for three, but took no heed of the passing time. At first there danced before his vision dim pictures of the storm, of the shafts, of the cob under his high duga. Then these pictures became exchanged for jumbled memories of the festival, of his wife, of the stanovoi, and of the candle locker. But beneath the picture of the candle locker lay Nikita. Then again he saw the mujiks trading with him, and the white iron-roofed walls of his house. But beneath the picture of those walls again lay Nikita. Then everything became confused. One thing ran into another, until at last these various scattered impressions came together as the colors of a rainbow merge into a beam of white light, and he fell asleep. For long he slept without dreaming, but just before the dawn came, there also came some sleep visions. He seemed to be standing by the candle locker while old Mother Tikhonova was asking him for a 5-kopeck candle for the festival. He tried to take the candle out and give it to her, but his hands remained glued in his pockets. Then he tried to walk round the locker, but his legs refused to move, and his new, clean shoes stuck fast to the stone floor, so that he could not even raise his feet to take the shoes off. Then suddenly the locker was not a locker at all, but a bed, and on that bed Vasily could see himself lying face downwards, lying on his own bed at home. He was lying on the bed and could not rise, although it was necessary for him to do so, seeing that Ivan Matveitch, the stanovoi, was coming to see him presently, and he must go with Ivan either to buy some timber or to put the crupper straight on the cob's back. He could not be sure which. He kept asking his wife, "Has he not come yet, Mikhailovna?" And she kept answering him, "No, not yet." Then he could hear someone driving up to the steps outside. Surely it must be he. But no, the vehicle had driven past. "Is he not come yet, Mikhailovna?" he asked his wife once more. And once more she replied, "No, not yet." Thus he lay, and lay upon the bed, unable to rise, and ever waiting, waiting. And the waiting was at once painful and joyous. Suddenly the joy of it was filled to the full. He for whose coming he had been waiting was now at hand, and it was not Ivan Matveitch nor anyone else. Yet still it was the man for whom he had been waiting. He entered, did that man, and called him. And this man who had called him cried out to him again, and bade him go and lie down upon Nikita. And Vasily was glad that this someone had come. "Yes, I will go," he cried in his joy. And with that cry, Vasily awoke. Yes, he awoke, but awoke a very different man to what he had been when he fell asleep. He tried to rise and could not. He tried to move his hand and could not. He tried to move his leg and could not. Then he tried to turn his head, but that also he could not do. This surprised him, yet in no way troubled him. Then he remembered that Nikita was lying beneath him, and that Nikita was growing warm and coming back to life. It seemed to him that he was Nikita, and Nikita he, and that his life was no longer within himself, but within Nikita. He strained his ears till he caught the sound of breathing, yes, the faint, deep breathing of Nikita. "Nikita is alive," he cried to himself in triumph, "and therefore so also am I." Then he began to think about his money, his store, his house, his sales and purchases, and Mironov's millions. He could not understand how that man, whom men called Vasily Brekhunov, could bear to interest himself in such things as he did. That man can never have known what is the greatest thing of all, he thought of this Vasily Brekhunov. He can never have known what I know. Yes, I know it for certain now. At last, I know. Once again, he heard the man calling him who had called to him before, and his whole being seemed to respond in joy and loving kindness as he replied, I am coming, I am coming. For he felt that he was free at last, and that nothing could hold him further. And indeed, nothing further than that did Vasily Andreyitch see or hear or feel in this world. Around him, the tempest still kept on. The same swirlings of snow kept circling in eddies and covering the coats of the dead Vasily Andreyitch and the trembling brownie and the sledge now almost invisible and stretched out upon its floor the now reviving Nikita as he lay prone beneath the body of his dead master. This ends Section 9. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Brooks Jensen, Anacortes, Washington. Master and Man by Leo Tolstoy. Section 10. Just before morning, Nikita awoke. It was the frost making its way down his back which aroused him. He had just been dreaming that he was driving from the mill with the load of his master's flour, and that, instead of taking the bridge over the stream, he went by the ford and stuck fast. He could see himself getting under the load and trying to lift it as he straightened his back. Yet, strange to say, the load would not move, but clung always to his back, so that he could neither move the cart nor withdraw himself from beneath it. It seemed to be breaking his very loins, and how cold it felt. At all costs, he must get away from beneath it. Hold on, he found himself saying to the someone who was causing the load to break his back. Take off some of the sacks. Yet the load kept growing colder and colder, and pressing more and more heavily upon him. Then suddenly, something gave a loud bang, and he became fully awake and remembered all that had happened. That chilly load, it was his dead frozen master. That loud bang, it had been caused by Brownie striking his hooves against the sledge. Andreyitch, Andreyitch, he cried cautiously to his master, though he half guessed the truth already, as he raised his back stiffly. But Andreyitch returned no answer, while his body and legs were cold and stiff and heavy as weights. There is no doubt that he is dead, thought Nikita. He turned his head round, pushed the snow away from in front of his face, and opened his eyes. It was quite light now. The wind was still humming through the shafts and the snow streaming down, but with this difference, that the snow was no longer dashing itself against the sides of the sledge, but piling itself up in silence over sledge and cob, from the latter of which not even the sound of breathing was now to be heard. Brownie, too, must be frozen, thought Nikita, and indeed those two loud hoof-strokes upon the sledge which had wakened him had been the last efforts of the now dead and frozen animal to keep upon his legs. O God, little Father of ours, surely thou wilt call me also, said Nikita, and if so, thy will be done. It would be hard that the two of us should be taken and the other left. Let death come when it will. And he drew his hand in again, closed his eyes, and fell asleep, firmly convinced that this time he was really and truly dead. It was about the time of the midday meal next day when some mujiks dug out Vasily and Nikita 70 yards only from the road and half a verst from the village. The snow had drifted completely over the sledge, but the shafts with the handkerchief on them were still visible. Brownie, belly deep in the snow, stood a white frozen mass, his dead muzzle pressed tightly inwards against his rigid neck, his nostrils fringed with icicles, and his eyes coated over and glazed with ice as with frozen tears. Moreover, he had so wasted away in that one night that there remained of him but skin and bones. As for Vasily, he too was stiff as a frozen carcass, and when his legs were pulled aside, the corpse rolled off Nikita in a solid lump. His prominent hawk-like eyes were frozen hard, and his mouth, open a little under his cropped mustache, filled with snow. Nikita only was alive, though frostbitten all over. Yet when brought to himself, he could not be persuaded that he was not dead, and that all that was now happening to him was not taking place in the next world instead of this. Indeed, his first feeling when he heard the mujiks shouting above him as they dug out the sledge and then rolled the stiffened Vasily off him was one of surprise that mujiks shouted in the next world even as they had shouted in this, and had similar bodies. When at length he understood that he was really here, here in this present world, he felt vexed rather than pleased, especially as he could feel that the fingers of both his hands were frostbitten. For about 2 months he lay in hospital. 3 of his fingers had to be amputated, but the others healed, so that he was able to go to work again and to live 20 years longer, first as a laborer, then in his old age as a watchman. Indeed, he died only this year, at home and under the icons, with a lighted wax candle in his hands, just as he had always wished. Before his death he took leave of his old wife and pardoned her for the cooper. He took leave also of his son and grandchildren, and died thoroughly happy to think that his death left his son and daughter-in-law freed from the burden of having a supernumerary mouth to feed, and that this time he himself would really pass from a life which had grown wearisome to him to that other life which had been growing more and more familiar and alluring to him each year and hour. Is he better or worse off now where he has awakened after his death, the death which really came that time? Is he disillusioned, or has he really found what he expected? Soon we shall all know. This ends section 10, and ends the book, Master and Man, by Leo Tolstoy.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.